Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison, and very soon, no more shows, because this is the penultimate edition of BOA Audio Season 10. This is the second to last one. We've got a huge finale planned for you, and I'll have details on that at the end of the show tonight. Or today, because it's 9 a.m. in the morning. This is crazy. But I'm all fired up, as you can tell, folks. So I'm ready to rock and roll, and our guest is definitely ready to rock and roll. And, you know, as I've been saying throughout the last year, as I've been interviewing all these folks who've been on the show in the past and some new folks, too, you know, I've been very, really careful with who I've had on in this final season. You'd almost call it like an artisan style podcast here. Every guest has been hand-selected by me and personally chosen from the vast pool of Banal of America guests we've had in the past and possible potential guests for the newcomers. And I knew there was one guest I really wanted to get back. And I was like, I don't even know if I can find him, you know, but it's one of the most talked-about shows we've ever done. And I would love to do a return to this topic, a refresher on the topic, and sort of celebrate the topic, because I think that what we're going to be talking about really kind of exemplifies the whole spirit of what this show's been about for the last 10-plus years. And that's, you know, exploring the strange and unusual and sort of demystifying the strange and unusual in a lot of ways. And going down roads that a lot of other places just wouldn't go. Because I don't think our guest has been on too many other podcasts, because most people hear the topic and they're like, "That's crazy, man. I'm not even gonna go there." But as soon as I heard the topic, I was like, "That's crazy, man. I want in." And so that's how we kind of came together back in 2011, and it was got to be one of the most talked about episodes we've done in the history of the show. People still bring up this stuff to me whenever we're talking about the show. So I knew, when I was wrapping things up, I really wanted to get him back on the show. And as luck would have it, we could make it happen, and we're so close to the end now. It was like, well, this guy and this topic, this is the perfect sort of penultimate episode, perfect final long form interview we're going to do for a while. So I knew that this was the one to hang our hat on. So I've teased it enough. You've probably already heard. If you're listening to this, it says it right on the MP3, I guess. Our guest is Cacullen O'Reilly of the Long Riders Guild, and what most people, he's kind of synonymous, I guess, if you're a listener to this show, with three simple words: meat-eating horses. As I said, every time, you know, people come up to me, they ask me about the show, we're talking about the show, events and stuff, meat-eating horses comes up almost every time. It was such a memorable addition to the program, and as I said, it's definitely one I wanted to revisit here as we close shop for the time being. So welcome back to the show, Cacullen. Thank you so much for returning to BOA Audio.
Hi, Tim. I'm glad to be back, and I'm looking forward to talking to you because I have a lot of new information to share with you and your listeners.
Nice, nice. Well, I figured you would because, like I said, it's been you know, about 6-7 years since we talked, so.
It's been 7 years, and it's interesting because when you contacted me the first time, it took me by surprise. Consequently, I was surprised again because I focus only on equestrian exploration. I don't listen to radio very often, and so the chance to speak to the public through you was a nice idea, and I'm glad to hear that people showed an interest in the concept of dangerous and meat-eating horses, because I think that you touched on a really important point. Things that we take for granted today would have been mysterious or unacceptable in previous generations. You know, Charles Darwin, the great historical long rider, he actually spent more time in the saddle than he did on the ship, the Beagle.
Oh, wow.
But when he came back to England, and after many years of thinking about it, you know, he announced his theory of evolution. It changed humanity, and it shook a lot of people up. But at the crossroads of every generation, you always find people who are standing there trying to guard against any kind of change or free thinking or new evidence. And so I think that what you're doing is offering the public a chance to really further understand horses and what they are potentially capable of doing and what they have done in the past. And so I think this is an overdue conversation. I'm glad to have it.
Absolutely. And like I said, easily one of the most memorable episodes of the show. People have asked me to sort of do a reprise of it, but I was like, I kind of wanted to save it for a special occasion. And as
well,
I said, you know,
I have to jump in and say that it wouldn't have been possible for this because I've been distracted. The only reason I talked to you in the beginning was because I had made an accidental discovery. I started off in 2010 to write what I thought was going to be a short book called The Horse Travel Handbook.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand at the time that I don't know if you know this or not, but up until 1925, the great Sphinx of Giza was buried up to its chin in sand.
Yes, yes,
nobody
actually.
Nobody had any idea how big it really was.
Right, yeah,
so
yeah,
I started
yeah.
making, when I started drawing, you know, writing this, what I thought was going to be a small book, it got bigger and bigger and longer and longer, and it ended up taking me 7 years, and the Horse Travel Handbook ended up becoming the 3-volume encyclopedia of equestrian exploration, and I only recently completed that. And so one of the topics that I investigated and documented while I was doing the encyclopedia was how humanity fed horses and how horses have the capability to be savage and to eat so many different things. And so it was. I've only just finished the encyclopedia, presented the first copy to Queen Elizabeth, and I'm only free now to talk to you at last.
Well, yeah, it's long overdue, man. It's long overdue. And you expressed some concern, I guess, when I emailed you. I kind of beating, no pun intended, I'm beating a dead horse here. That, yeah, folks, don't freak out. You know, we're going to be back eventually with other stuff. So it's not like this is the end of the whole Been All of America franchise. This is just the end of the podcast as you know it, I guess you could say. That's probably the best way to put it. So don't, you know, chances are this isn't the last time we'll talk to Cullen, but it may be the last time for a while. So, yeah, I just wanted to make that point in case people somehow, why would they tune out? Because we're going to be fucking tearing it up right now.
If we're going to talk about horses, I mean, you know, and it's interesting that we're using technology to discuss this ancient relationship with this other important species. I think it's great that we're using radio to do that. So what I think is obviously also really interesting is how technology has become such a dominant part of most humans' lives, but horses and horse history, whereas it helped shape human history and civilization as we know it, it's basically now a victim of sort of mass amnesia. So I think that we need to ask, you know, and discuss a lot of things about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I was thinking about that when you were talking when we started the show just now, because I'll never forget what I learned the first time I interviewed you, and that was just about how, you know, the whole civilization especially sort of like right before the car came along. Like there were like millions of horses that they were using for transportation, and then you know, they wiped them all out once the car came out. And it's like people don't, like you said about the collective amnesia, it's like people don't realize just how massive the horse population was throughout the world, especially in cities and stuff like that, and they wiped them all out.
All right, we can talk about equinocide in just a minute.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll touch on that in a minute, but let's just take a test of what we all collectively know today. I mean, for the sake of your audience, I mean, just imagine me asking you some questions and like, you know, hands up if you own a mobile phone, or hands up if you can operate an ATM machine, or if you belong to Facebook.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now hands up if you know how to change the needle on a photograph, or if you know how to drive a manual transmission car, or if you know the difference between a hackamore and a halter. Now, all the first examples involve machines and technology,
mm-hmm.
but very few people nowadays, especially in different countries, have ever seen a horse, have ever touched a horse, or ridden, or even traveled on a horse. And so what this discussion is about how knowledge is generational. And some of this knowledge is passing out of, it's becoming extinct, or that's what the Guild's trying to preserve it from becoming extinct.
Hmm.
But as the 21st century progresses, more and more people are migrating into increasingly larger urban centers, and they're losing touch with not just nature, but with horses.
Yeah. Well, refresh the audience on the equinocide, because like I said, that was one thing that when I came out of the original conversation with you, I was like mind blown. Just I was like, this is, you know, as I said, I mean, there were millions of horses, and you can elaborate on this, but there were millions of horses in cities across the world. As soon as they started rolling out cars, they had no need for the horses, and you know, they wiped them out pretty much.
It's not just horses. We used to live, we as a species used to be part of a world that was populated with animals. And in an increasingly mechanized world, it's difficult to comprehend how many animals once populated our planet. For example, at the beginning of the 19th century, there were 30 million buffalo in North America. But by 1890, there were less than 5,000 of them. And in 1949, an American, Leonard Clark, rode across Tibet. He counted 1,000 wild equines in one herd. And so the whole population of animals themselves have diminished so dramatically and drastically. Horse use, you brought up equinocide.
Yeah.
The horse was such a part of everyday civilization. In the encyclopedia, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but it talks about the huge numbers of horses that populated, they were urban herds of horses. It was a world fueled on hay, not gas. And cities like New York would, you know, routinely house, tens and tens of thousands. One example in the encyclopedia shows a four-story stable in Germany. There was a ramp that led up, and they would take the horses up by their hundreds and put them inside this giant building. In New York, I think it was in the 1880s. There was a stable, one entire stable that took up an entire city block.
Wow!
So the number of animals and in the world, and the number of horses in the cities was tremendous. But with the onset of the mechanical age, these things really, really, really changed. For example, when Joseph Stalin took power. And I think it was 1928. Between 1928 and 1930, they implemented a new ruthless agricultural program in Russia, and 47% of all the horses in Russia were killed.
Jeez.
So the demise in horses, in farming, in the military, in travel, in the last century has brought about a disconnection with people, with horses.
Right.
So that's what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. They were almost like commonplace at the turn of last century, and now it's like they're for most people, I think they're kind of like exotic in a way, which is crazy to think about, you know.
Well, I'll give you an example. I was thinking about your audience. So your audience has access to television and movies and the cinema.
I hope so.
So you are subjected to a steady stream of equine images. All right, you see cowboy movies, or you see, you know, people riding in parades, etc. And since I last talked to you, an incredible incident happened. Two long riders set off to ride from the top of Africa to the bottom of Africa, Billy Benchley and Christine Hinchy. And they had left Tunisia, ridden all the way across North Africa, down through the Sudan, went down the Nile, and then they reached Uganda. And when they got there, absolute pandemonium ensued because nobody had seen a horse in Uganda since 1966.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And in the photographs that I sent you, there's a photograph of Billy surrounded by hundreds of school children. At one point, 800 children came charging out of a school to see the first horse they had ever seen in their life. And it was interesting what the children asked Billy, because he and I discussed this, and he remembered the questions. They said, "Is that a kangaroo?" And they wanted to know, "Does it speak Arabic or English?" And does it eat people? And they wanted to know if it was faster than a bus. So this connection with horses is it depends on which country you're talking about.
Right.
But
right.
It's obviously it's spreading.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty amazing. That's surprising to hear. I kind of just jumped into this because I expect that people know who you are and everything, because this episode, the episode you're originally on is like famous in, as far as Banal of America goes. But I'll let me give the thumbnail. Let me give the thumbnail bio now that we're like 15 minutes in the interview. Colin O'Reilly, he's an investigative reporter who spent more than 30 years studying equestrian travel techniques on every continent. He founded the Long Riders Guild, the world's international association of equestrian explorers. The organization has members in 46 countries, all of whom have made a qualifying equestrian journey of at least 1,000 miles. The Guild has supported equestrian expeditions on every continent except Antarctica. He's also the author of the Encyclopedia of Equestrian Exploration and the book that really we're focusing on here in this conversation, Deadly Equines. Let me see what the subtitle is for Deadly Equines, because that's Deadly Equines, The Shocking True Story of Meat-Eating and Murderous Horses. And as I said, anybody who listens to this show has at some point either brought up the meat-eating horses or asked me some kind of question about it, or, you know, if they ask me, like, about my favorite shows, I'll mention it, and then they'll be like, "Oh, my God, I love that one." So that's why I wanted to have you on here as we close down the party. Now, how did go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, when did this, because I want to, like, sort of segue into the meat-eating horses part of things, and it's like, how did you originally come upon this idea, I guess you could say? Like, what was the spark in your mind where you were like, wait a minute, something's going on here that maybe people don't know about?
It was a Frenchman, Jean-Louis Gouraud. Jean-Louis Gouraud is France's premier living equine historian. And we were talking, and because France has a different colonial history than England, Jean-Louis grew up with different horse stories than you or I or our people in London would normally associate with. And during one of our discussions, he casually mentioned one African tribe would raid another African tribe, and they were riding horses. And I thought, you know, I'm sorry, I'm thinking about Zulu, Michael Caine, you know.
Yeah.
Years. I didn't know Africans rode horses, and I didn't think about that. And then he said, and then when they would raid the people, they would kill them, and then they would feed the dead babies to the horses. And my brain just went, I'm sorry. There was this frozen moment. I didn't take that on board. And that was the first episode I ever heard of where horses had consumed human flesh or any flesh. I thought, I'm sorry, you know, horses eat grass. you know, a horse, a cow,
yeah.
a peaceful herbivore. They mean us no harm, you know, that whole mythology.
Mm-hmm.
As I started doing the research for the encyclopedia, what I discovered was that our cultural interpretation of horses strongly influences what we feed them and how we interpret them, and even how we react to them. You know, if you think a horse isn't dangerous and you let your toddler go around it, there could be seriously negative repercussions, to put it politely.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thing all came about quite by accident because of this Frenchman.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I remember, as I said, talking originally, and one of the things that sort of stuck with me also was, you know, you kind of succinctly put it in a sense where it's like, I really, and the listeners too, unless they're like really into horses, you know, I really have no like emotional investment into whether or not horses eat meat or not, you know? So it's like people need, when they first hear this idea, I think their brain kind of shuts off because it's like that's, you know, it goes against everything they've been taught by the media, maybe in school, but at the same time, it's like really, it's kind of like a basic thing. It's like maybe it's not a big deal if horses eat meat, folks. It's not like it doesn't upend your worldview, you know. So people need to be open minded about the possibility here.
There's two topics in here, and I'd like to focus on one.
Mm-hmm.
And the topic of the book is deadly equine, and what has happened. In the ensuing 7 years is that more research has been uncovered from around the world, which proves that horses are much more deadly than the majority of people believe or understand or appreciate, and that previous generations of human beings not only knew this, but they took advantage of this, and they wrote about it quite frequently. For example, just a week ago, I received a very rare book from India, and there was a translated Sanskrit poem from 1070.
Oh, wow.
And it told the story of a famous mare called Kabutri, and I'm quoting from Sanskrit now, and it says, "Where her master killed 3 with his sword, she killed 10 with her feet and teeth." So this idea that horses are these, you know, lovable ponies, they mean you no harm, this is something that has become a pervasive idea, but mm-hmm. it's not based in historical accuracy.
Right. It's almost like a new idea.
It is a new idea. For
yeah.
example, you know, when Arthur Conan Doyle, who everybody knows, wrote Sherlock Holmes, he didn't write just that. He was a great historical writer as well. And he wrote a famous book about the Hundred Years' War, and he talks in that book about how this one horse grabbed a priest and just savages him to bits. And back in 2011, I mentioned and explained how people had lost touch with this part.
Right.
But this has changed dramatically since you and I first talked.
Really?
Yes, it has, because now, I can't attribute this to your show, but what I can tell you is that the perception that horses can be dangerous is definitely growing. And you can see that in the work of a really well-known best-selling English author named Bernard Cornwell. Back in the 1980s, he wrote a series of best-selling books about a man called Richard Sharp. They made a TV series about him, Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But more recently, Cornwell's written a new series about a Saxon warrior named Uthred, which I think you can see there in America as well. And Uthred rides this deadly black stallion called Torment, and that horse routinely bites people's faces off and disembowels them. And so not only did people in the past know about this, okay, but now people are writing it into current television, books, you're going to see, I think, more and more people are going to be able to accept the fact that horses are much more aggressive than they suspected.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, I mean, once you kind of, like I said, once that idea gets planted into your head, then you start to see things in a whole different light. So that's for sure. Now, what we talked in 2011, what kind of, I'm sure, you know, back then you were getting new accounts all the time. So, what's the latest sort of stuff you've heard?
I've got an account that I pulled this up. I've got two things. I've got two accounts that I'm going to tell you
about.
Back in 2011, the book had come out, and I talked about an infamous deadly stallion from Canada called Rysdek. In 1886, this horse, this stallion, had killed four men. And I gave you that example when we first talked. And in fact, I sent you an image just before I rang you. And you can see in the image, you can see Rysdek grabbing this man by the shoulder. And imagine a dog grabbing a rat and shaking it. Now, that's what an equine does. When an equine normally attacks a human being, they grab them either on the face or on the shoulder, and they shake them viciously.
Yeah.
Now, Rysdek, back in 2011, was what I thought was the first example. But recently, a new example came in. And let me just jump in and tell you that unsolicited evidence has been arriving nonstop for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay? So stuff just – email comes in and goes, oh, by the way, you don't know about this. And that's how this happened. I received the story of Harry Gant. He's a cowboy who lived in Fort Collins, Colorado. And I've never shared this story because it just came in. But I'm quoting now, quote, this happened at noon Friday, May the 23rd, 1890, in Fort Collins. An imported Percheron stallion weighing 1,900 pounds was being led down the main street of the town by his groom, a man named Thompson. The stallion broke free, turned on Thompson, grabbed him by the shoulder, and threw him 20 feet. The horse then rushed over and landed on Thompson's chest with both his knees and crushing him. Then the horse began tearing Thompson to shreds while people on the sidewalk looked on helplessly. People rushed to the hardware store for guns but were stopped on account of the danger of hitting some people. And then an old cowhand came up and roped the horse and got him into a barn. And then Harry goes on to say, it was found out later that this horse had killed a man in France before being sold to a cowboy outfit in Wyoming where he had killed another man. I sent you Harry Gant's photograph as
well. Yeah, I see it, yeah.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that people like Harry Gant and people in India and previous generations, they were fully aware that horses were capable of this incredible aggression.
Yeah.
And they actually used this in combat, as the Sanskrit poem from India proves. But more recently, there in America, there have been episodes where, for example, the American long rider, Bernice Indy, she started riding back in 2005. She's ridden 25,000 miles during 8 journeys in the United States and Canada.
Wow.
And she's the only person to ever ride ocean to ocean in both directions on the same journey. And in a recent interview I did with her, Bernice recalled how the worst thing that ever happened was how she was nearly killed by a horse one night in New Mexico. She was sleeping outside when a Mustang stallion attacked her, and she managed to drive him off with a rope, and she said it was worse than being attacked by a grizzly bear.
Dear God, yeah. Jeez, that sounds rough, man.
Well, I think this is what the problem here is that most modern people lump horses in with cows, and they think that they're nonviolent herbivores and that they use their teeth to nibble succulent greenery.
Yeah, yeah.
And in actuality, horses can be incredibly dangerous because they're so equipped by nature to harm human beings.
Yeah, yeah, that's the point, yeah, especially, yeah. I mean, I've been around horses, so it's like, they're kind of, they are intimidating. They're not kind of, they are intimidating. I mean, they're huge, man. They're like, they're massive. I think people,
well,
you know.
A horse is really agile. He can run, he can jump, he's got a mouthful of teeth. He's 7 times stronger than the strongest man. And when a horse kicks you, it's like being struck by a bowling ball traveling at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So the ferocity of a horse attack is something that's just, you have to, it's a horrible thing. If you will notice, this is something else that happened. Weeks after the book was published and soon after I had done the interview with you, I was contacted by a woman in Australia. And she wrote to say, thank you for publishing the book and warning the public. And she then went on to tell me about her unfortunate daughter. And I sent you a photograph. You can see that young woman's face.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the giant mark where a Frisian horse has grabbed that woman. And what makes this story so poignant is that this Frisian horse had been raised by this mother from a foal. She had had this horse his entire life.
Right.
And her 18-year-old daughter was holding the horse. And I'll quote this email for you.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was holding him when, like a switch, he attacked her instantaneously by trying to rip her throat out.
Ugh.
He went for two consecutive blows, with the first one tearing the flesh from her chin. That's what you can see in the photograph. And then the second one hitting her shoulder. And he was aiming for her throat when she fell to the ground. He only missed her jugular by millimeters. And then the mother rushed in and grabbed her and saved her life. You can see the savage size of the bite.
Yeah. I'm not going to share this with people, but it's gruesome.
It's evidence that horses are much more dangerous than people understand. And in 2012, a mayor of Texas, William Bolke, was killed. And in 2013, a man in Hungary, Sandor Horvath, he was killed. So these things have been going on for a long, long time.
Yeah. It might also be, too, that there's a thing where it's like there's not as many horses now as there were back then. So it's like, I wouldn't know if somebody got attacked by a horse, like in the town next to me. So it's, but maybe back in the day you would. You know what I mean?
Well, actually, we have a lot of horses in the world. We're just not in contact with them on a daily basis.
Right. That's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, your great-grandfather would have known how to hook up a horse to a wagon. Your grandfather probably rode horses on errands. And previous generations in different countries were riding horses right up until the 1940s and 50s. As a matter of fact, we just received information about the Somali equestrian culture, and they waged the longest war against colonial aggression of any people in Africa, and they were mounted warriors, and they fought right up until the 1940s. So horses used to be a much bigger part of human life on
right.
a daily basis.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's pretty wild. Now, when we were talking to set up this conversation, you mentioned that you've been looking at child, horses attacking children.
Right, because this is one of the reasons I was glad to talk to you again. I for the sake of argument, you're 6 feet tall and you weigh 180 pounds and you're an athletic, fit man. And, if you see what looks like an aggressive animal coming toward you, you can pick up a big stick and go, hey, get back,
Yeah.
We can all picture and visualize as adults who are listening to a radio show, we think, oh, yeah, I could do that. I could save myself. But what I discovered and what was really upsetting was the historical documentation of children who were victims of horse attacks.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you said, well, it might happen, but I wouldn't know about it because, it's not happening. Well, it is happening, and it's happening right now, or it has happened just recently. And I have before me a list of children victims. The first one I came across, I mentioned back when we did the original interview, in 1855, an English author was in India. When he encountered this infamous horse called the Man-Eater of Lucknow, and he says, and this is according to his eyewitness account, that he saw coming towards him a large bay stallion trotting down the road. Dangling from his mouth was a dead child, which the horse was shaking savagely. Nevertheless, when he saw me in my buggy, the horse threw the toddler on the road and immediately rushed to attack me.
Oh, jeez.
And that guy got away. And we talked about that the first time. But what's happened since then is that people have been sending in newspaper accounts or historical evidence. And I sent you another photograph of a episode in 1874. There's an image from the Albany, Illinois. In 1874, a horse broke free from a man, rushed into the house, grabbed the baby out of its crib, and bit it and was shaking it to death when the father rushed in and saved it. You can see that in one of the images that I shared.
Yeah.
But then the attacks continue. Some horses, I don't know why, I'm not a scientist, I can't say that I can give you any scientific reason for this, but there's a steady stream of this. In 1931, a horse attacked a six-year-old child in Liverpool, England, rushed across the street and grabbed it in front of its mother. And then it goes up into our century, and back when I first talked to you, I had already learned that little four-year-old Bailey Stockton in Concord, Oklahoma, he was attacked. According to the local sheriff, the little boy was playing in his backyard by the back door, and a horse, which was grazing 50 yards away from the home, it saw the boy, and with no provocation, it ran over, jumped the fence, and grabbed the child by the throat and killed it. And that happened in 2001. And since I've been talking to you, in 2011, in Suffolk, England, the newspaper reported that a horse had grabbed a number of children and adults, but especially children, as they were walking down a path. It would wait for them and lurk by the path.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And then, of course, I sent you the photograph of little Stephen Goldsmith, and he was 3 years old. He was walking with his mom down the path. The horse was leaning up there against the fence, and you can clearly see in the photograph where the horse grabbed little Stephen by the front of his chest, picked him up, bit him, and then threw him through the air. So we have there's a growing body of evidence here about equine aggression. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, for sure. You don't want to leave your kids around these things unattended, folks.
Well, that's true. And I think that when there's an American long rider who recently finished her second journey through the Nevada desert, and Nevada has a huge population of wild feral horses,
right.
And she was continually attacked. Her and her horse were continually attacked by wild horses out there.
Really?
Yeah, that's right. Really. And so we're not talking like she was provoking them or chasing them or hunting them. They would see her and they would come over after her and attempt to attack either her or her horse. And this is why, while she was in the saddle and while she was, in her tent.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Is this like a territorial thing, you think?
It is. It is. Horses are very territorial, especially stallions, and they're curious. And as the evidence clearly indicates, they can be tremendously destructive. And this is the concept that I like to get across to people. Horse whisperers, that genre that people call horse whisperers, they say, the horse is a herbivore. It means you no harm. It always flees from danger. And history proves that that's not true.
Right.
That there are, look, I'm sure you've never killed another human being, and I'm sure most dogs haven't killed other dogs, but we both accept the fact that there are dogs and are humans that can do that.
Yeah.
And that's what we're discussing about horses.
Right,
exactly. We're asking modern people to go, wait a minute, I need to step back here and reconsider this idea.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was talking about earlier with regards to our original conversation. It's like, that's what encompasses the whole spirit of this show for all these years. It's you take a step back and reexamine, what you think you know in light of what you're being told by the guest, and make a judgment for yourself. And I think nothing exemplifies that more than the meat-eating horses concept.
I think that applies to a lot of things. People A lot people have conceived strong preconceptions about different things: religion, politics, animals, sexuality. Who knows?
Yeah.
But you know, when it comes to the historical evidence of destructive actions, for example, most people in modern America, for example, they don't want to undergo a fundamental change in how they see this, because this brings up the idea of how is the horse perceived today, you know, by most modern Americans. And it's, you know, evidence is one thing, but cultural bias is something else. And their personal and cultural bias prevents an objective reappraisal of what we're talking about.
Right, exactly. Absolutely, yeah. Like you said, the Disneyfication, however you said it, you know, of horses. They become this sort of cartoon caricature where it's like, there's a lot more to it, folks. There's a lot more to it.
Well, I've got a question to ask you and your listeners.
Sure.
And, you know, and this is kind of a giveaway, but it's an important point. It's about humans and horses, and I'm going to ask you. The question is, what do the Shango tribe in Nigeria and the Assyrians, the Buddhists, the Celts, the Hindus, Islam, and that's Sunnis and Shias, Christianity, oh, that's Old and New Testament, the Jains, Judaism, the Mormons, the Vikings, Persians, Romans, Japanese Shinto, and the Sikhs? What do all those things have in common? And the answer is they all have examples of horses either being worshipped, or they have stories of horses in their sacred texts, or they depict horses in statues, paintings, or icons. And in every single example of that, these are images that are positive, and the horse is seen as an image, as a powerful ally and a force for good in a fight against evil.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is a different aspect of the horse's nature that most modern people have lost touch with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's that's why we're trying to bring them up to speed, Colin, right?
That's right. Well, you know, and I think this is, you know, we base religion on personal beliefs, and but beliefs change. And, you know, for example, nobody today believes in. There was a white stallion called Svintovit, and he was a white stallion that the Slavic pagans believed could foretell the future.
Yeah.
And nobody believes that anymore. And nobody believes that Neptune still travels across the ocean pulled in a chariot by waves, you know, horses made from water.
Yeah.
These all seem really silly. But those beliefs were, you know, things that people used to believe in, and they were quite common. But the idea that horses could be deadly, or that horses' diets could be not what we think they are, they have a problem grasping that.
Yeah, and it's such a to me, it's just like, as I said before, it's like people shouldn't. Why would you have an emotional investment in what horses eat? Like, I don't, unless you're a super horse aficionado or something, and then you should, you know, I'm guessing that maybe you already would kind of be hip to what this is all about, you know.
Well, when we talked the first time, I discussed how I had made the, to me, startling discovery that horses had played such an important part in polar exploration. When there was an English long rider named Henry Jackson, and he had gone to Siberia and crossed Siberia using the famous Siberian Yakut horses. They can survive in minus 60-degree weather.
Wow.
They can go into a state of semi-hibernation. They have special hair, which retains their heat. And so when Jackson used these horses in Siberia, he also realized that they could – this is in the 1890s. Nobody had reached either the North or the South Pole. So when he decided he was going to try to – live for a year in Arctic conditions, he took Siberian horses with him. And the first time I talked to you, I explained to you about how one of Jackson's horses was a great fan of eating polar bear meat. And he just gobbled it up. It was actually a mare. And when Jackson returned to England after spending a year up in the Arctic, Sir Ernest Shackleton, who went on to become a famous Antarctic explorer, he spoke to Jackson, and they talked about how powerful horses were and how much more they could pull than dogs. But, of course, there's no grass in Antarctica. And I explained to you the first time around that I had made the discovery that based on Jackson's observation, Sir Ernest Shackleton went to the British military, and the British military knew that horses could eat meat. They had observed this in different cultures, and they actually had it in their British cavalry manual that horses were capable of eating meat or fat or blood or et cetera.
Yeah.
So Shackleton went to the famous military depot at Aldershot, and they created something called the Maugy Ration. And it was kind of a pemmican for horses, and it was sugar and meat and some other components. But the basic component was that it was meat. And so Shackleton used this to feed his horses on the way to the South Pole. And that much we knew in 2011 when I talked to you. But
yeah.
What I also discovered since then was that this idea of feeding horses meat was carried on. Professor Harold Goldschmidt, who was Denmark's most famous equine nutritionalist and scientist at the beginning of the 20th century, he had learned about the Maugy Ration from Shackleton. And he was fully aware that horses could consume protein. And so when a man named Captain Johan Koch decided that he was going to try to cross Greenland with horses in 1911, Professor Goldschmidt, he also invented a kind of meat-based ration, and that's what they fed the horses when they went across Greenland. So the idea that these animals can survive on protein and not just grain or just grass or just hay depends on the culture and where you come from.
Now, I have two questions for you. First, do you know, like, because now I'm kind of like got mad scientist brain, right? Because it's like still, this is technically early in the morning for me. It's 10 a.m., it shouldn't be. Do we know the recipe of this Maugy Ration? And that's sort of one thing. And then the second, now I assume, based on your work and everything, that you have horses. Have you fed them meat? Have you ever fed them meat? That's it. That's the question. Have you ever fed your horses meat?
Wait. It's the first thing is that as soon as I found out about the Maugy Ration,
yeah.
I contacted the British military, and I said, "What about this?" And they were dumbfounded. They didn't know about Shackleton. As a matter of fact, I have a photograph of Sir Ernest Shackleton's compass here on my desk. I know his daughter, Alexandra, and I'm holding a picture. The photograph is me holding Sir Ernest's compass that he took down to the South Pole. Shackleton's attempt his creation was really significant. And when there was three men and one horse left, and they were on their way to the South Pole, and the horses had shown such an appetite for the Maugy Ration that they enjoyed eating it more than they did their grain. And so the humans that were with the horses twigged this, and they actually sampled it. And at one point during the journey to the South Pole, Shackleton and his two human colleagues and the surviving horse all ate the Maugy Ration, which means it's the first time in history that humans and horses sat down and ate meat together that I know of.
Right.
But the British military don't have the recipe. They I don't know if it was lost or overlooked. But what we do know from Shackleton's writing is in my book Deadly Equines. That much we know about. And yes, I did try to feed meat. My wife's Cossack stallion. She rode Count Pompey from 2,500 miles from Volgograd to back to England. And when this started becoming known to us, we asked ourselves, well, you know, will he eat it? And the answer was no. He turned his nose up at it. But what's interesting is the number of people that have written to me since then with evidence, and I have 153 messages. The last one was received in December the 15th, 2017, and they go back to the last time I talked to you. So the evidence keeps coming in about horses eating jerky, horses in Yakutia eating fish, horses, God, I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
Horses eating blood in Tibet. In Deadly Equines, hold on, let me go to the front of the book. There is a map, and this, of course, this map is way out of date now, but there is a map in the front of the book that starts and it goes back to 900 AD, and it lists all the places in the world that horses have been found to eat different types of flesh. And even back then, the last time that you and I talked, I had already documented that horses had been known to eat antelope, beef, birds, chicken, fish, goat, hamsters, horses, humans, moose, polar bears, rabbits, seals, sheep, tigers, whales, and yaks.
Wow.
You know,
where's the hamster? Well, how did a hamster get eaten by a horse?
I had, you know, I have to go back to the
What the hell were those two doing together? God. Yeah.
What I also would like to know is, when we talked last time, did we talk about the Nazi expedition that went into Tibet and filmed the horses drinking and eating blood?
I think we may have. I mean, feel free to talk about it, man. I mean, there's some people who haven't heard the episode before, heard it in 7 years. So, let's hear it.
We have to understand that, I didn't grow up, I grew up watching Roy Rogers on a black and white TV, okay? And, I saw, the Lone Ranger on Saturday, and so when the Lone Ranger and Tonto got off, they got off and they give, Silver and Scout some hay, They didn't feed them hamburgers. But so our cultural perceptions are really strong, and what we see and perceive are based on our childhood and what our friends and our elders tell us. But in Deadly Equines, there's a really ominous photograph. It's actually a woodcut, and it's from the 16th century. And it shows a horse. A man has been killed. He's been killed by a warrior, a soldier, and the horse is, happily devouring the entrails of this dead human. And you would think that that's just, that's horrible. That's ridiculous. But then, as I was telling you, I'm trying to find the page here where it talks about this.
Well, I think while you're looking for that, I think I'll re-stress a point I recall making in the original conversation, and that was that we're dealing with like sort of two separate phenomena here, folks. We're talking about that horses eat meat. That's one thing.
That's right.
And the other is that they can be aggressive and deadly. So there's two different,
right.
That's why it's, meat eating and murderous horses. There's two.
That's right.
Colin has uncovered two sort of two strains here that are very, very remarkable and thought-provoking.
And I think that's why, it's called Deadly Equines, but the subtitle is the story of meat-eating and murderous horses because, like we began at the beginning of this conversation, people don't think of horses as being murderous. When I first talked to you, I gave you an example of how. And I can remember this was the shocking moment for me when I had the conversation with the Frenchman and he told me about horses eating children in Africa. My brain just couldn't grasp that. I have since learned that those kind of things do happen in different cultures and horses do consume people. But what was really hard for me to grasp personally was the story of a woman who was killed in Alaska. And as you know, there's a lot of grizzly bears in Alaska. And the book describes how this horse, known to this woman, owned by this woman for a long time, she went in to do some routine chore, and the horse, again, like the Frisian horse who attacked the young woman in Australia, for no discernible reason, this horse killed its owner. And what was so disturbing was what the Alaskan police officer said. He said, "I've seen a lot of victims of grizzly bear attacks, but what I saw in that stable was worse than anything else I'd ever seen." And so it's that perception that we need to change.
Right.
You know, it's the idea that, you know, we don't know it all. And I think that's what's so great about your show. You're going, hello, we need to open up our minds here. And let's consider the fact that there's a lot of evidence that other cultures and nations know about that we aren't privy to.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And just don't base your stuff on cartoons.
Yeah, well, you know, let's talk about cartoons, and let's talk about, you know, let's talk about what Hollywood does. We have this, you know, for example, there was a cartoon called, I think it's called Spirit Stallion, some kind of cartoon about a mustache.
Yeah, it sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cartoon, and it's a cartoon, you know, and it's got, you know, a character, bad guy, supposed to look like, you know, General George Armstrong Custer, and, you know, bad guy, good horse, that's a cartoon, you know. And, well, what we're discussing is the reality of horses, and, you know, some horses, just like some human beings, can be tremendously lethal. And like I said, too, like you just pointed out, there's this new idea about this dietary evidence. And that's why I brought up the Nazis. And I do have the info here. It was in 1938 when an expedition was organized by Heinrich Himmler. And he sent in Dr. Ernest Schaefer and a team of German explorers. And they went into Tibet. And what they discovered shocked them, of course, being Europeans and horsemen themselves. They watched a Tibetan post rider arrive, come riding up, and they saw a Tibetan lead up a goat and cut its throat, drain the blood into a bowl, and then they mixed barley in with the bowl, and all of this is being filmed by the Nazi film crew. The tired post horse then walks up to the bowl and eagerly eats up the sheep blood and the barley.
Jeez. And what do the Nazis think of this?
Well, one of the things that, and this is not directly involved with what we're discussing, but this is an offshoot of that. One of the things that's explored and discussed and revealed in the encyclopedia is the largely unknown use by Hitler of horses in his military establishment. It's a common perception that the Blitzkrieg was all about machinery and technology and how deadly they were. The Nazis had they had the V2 rocket and they had the Tiger tank. And they had fantastic machine guns, but they didn't have a lot of gas. And here's something else that's really culturally interesting. They didn't have a lot of drivers. Americans, by the 1920s, with thanks to Henry Ford, lots of Americans knew how to drive cars, but owning a car in Germany was prohibitively expensive. Generally only rich people could own a car, and not a lot of people knew how to drive in Germany. So you didn't have a lot of drivers for the German army. And on top of that, there weren't enough vehicles for the German army. And so when Hitler went to war, he employed more than 1 million horses. And then they confiscated horses in every country they went into. And so by the time Hitler went into Russia, there was about, I think it was 1.7 million horses in the German military.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so you had this giant military machine fueled by horses. And in the encyclopedia, what I also talk about is how it's been swept under the carpet that the Germans viewed the horse as being a symbol of their national superiority. And so when they held the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, the Germans won more gold medals in the equestrian sports than has ever been won ever.
Oh, wow, really?
They took them all, okay? And it was, I uncovered SS posters showing the SS officers with the SS slogan, and they were showing them at the Olympics. And what I also uncovered was how Hitler had, once Hitler annexed Austria, he was quick to put a Nazi in charge of the Spanish riding school where the Lipizzans are. And the Lipizzans then became a part of Nazi propaganda. And the encyclopedia has a copy of a Nazi propaganda pamphlet with the Lipizzan stallion, you know, rearing back on its hind legs with the swastika up on the bottom top.
Yeah.
They actually held a special performance for Eva Braun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Nazis and horses and all that stuff that was known to those guys. Again, it's just more evidence of how little we really know and how much more there is to discover.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure, I mean, you're getting these accounts all the time, right? So it's like...
Absolutely, they're still coming in. I mean, what have I got here? I mean, I just got in late last year, we got film evidence of horses in Yakutia. That's over in Siberia. And the horses routinely eat fish. And so, you know, there's this film, you know, and the horse is just gobbling a frozen fish like it's some sort of, you know, candy.
Yeah.
There's something about that horse, Buster. You know, it's like we looked at each other, and then there was eye contact, and I was looking at the horse, and the horse was looking at me, and then it hit me. I think, maybe, I was a centaur in my past life.
Well, something tells me you probably were never half man, half horse, but hell, what do I know?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Dude, I think I was a centaur in my past life. It totally occurred to me.
What makes you think you're half man, half horse?
Charlie.
Come on, out. He's working.
I'm enjoying a roll.
He's working.
Bro, will you please get out of here? You smell like cheese.
No.
You
all do right,
smell
it's horrible.
Well, whatever it is, it's terrible, okay?
Well, let's call it what it is. It's horrible. I have it all over my hands.
Charlie, let's go. Get up.
Cheese.
Well, the horse was eating a lot of cheese then. I don't know what it is. Just you stink.
Come on, get up.